Chapter 7. It was a hot place to camp, under trees that had been girdled to kill them so that the tsetse flies would leave. And there was hard hunting in the hills, which were steep, brushy, and very broken, with a hard climb before you got up into them, and easy hunting on wooded flats where you wandered as though through a deer park. But everywhere were tsetse flies, swarming around you, biting hard on your neck, through your shirt, on arms, and behind the ears. I carried a leafy branch and swished away at the back of my neck as we walked and we hunted 5 days, from daylight until dark, coming home after dark, dead tired but glad of the coolness and of the darkness that stopped the tsetse from biting. We took turns hunting the hills and the flats, and Carl became steadily gloomier, although he killed a very fine roan antelope. He had gotten a very complicated personal feeling about kudu, and, as always, when he was confused, it was someone's fault. The guides, the choice of beat, the hills, these all betrayed him. The hills punished him, and he did not believe in the flats. Each day I hoped he would get one, and that the atmosphere would clear, but each day his feelings about the kudu complicated the hunting. He was never a climber and took real punishment in the hills. I tried to take the bulk of the hill beats to relieve him, but I could see, now that he was tired, he felt they probably were in the hills, and he was missing his chance. In the 5 days, I saw a dozen or more kudu cows and one young bull with a string of cows. The cows were big, gray, striped flank antelope with ridiculously small heads, big ears, and a soft, fast-rushing gait that moved them in big-bellied panic through the trees. The young bull had the start of a spiral on his horns, but they were short and dumpy, and as he ran past us at the end of the glade in the dusk, third in a string of 6 cows, he was no more like a real bull than a spike elk is like a big, old, thick-necked, dark-maned, wonder-horned, tawny-hided, beer-horse-built bugler of a bull elk. Another time, headed home as the sun went down along a steep valley in the hills, the guides pointed to 2 gray, white-striped moving animals against the sun at the top of the hill, showing only their flanks through the trunks of the trees, and said they were kudu bulls. We could not see the horns, and when we got up to the top of the hill, the sun was gone, and on the rocky ground we could not find their tracks. But from the glimpse we had, they looked higher in the legs than the cows we saw, and they might have been bulls. We hunted the ridges until dark, but never saw them again, nor did Carl find them the next day when we sent him there. We jumped many water buck, and once, still hunting along a ridge with a steep gully below, we came on a water buck that had heard us, but not scented us, and as we stood, perfectly quiet, Imkola holding his hand on mine, we watched him. Only a dozen feet away, standing, beautiful, dark, full-necked, a dark ruff on his neck, his horns up, trembling all over as his nostrils widened, searching for the scent. Imkola was grinning, pressing his fingers tight on my wrist, and we watched the big buck shiver from the danger that he could not locate. Then there was the distant heavy boom of a native black powder gun, and the buck jumped and almost ran over us as he crashed up the ridge. Another day with POM along, we had hunted all through the timbered flat and come out to the edge of the plain where there were only clumps of bush and sansevieria when we heard a deep, throaty cough. I looked at Imkola.
"Simba,"
he said, and did not look pleased.
"Wapi?"
I whispered.
"Where?"
He pointed. I whispered to POM. "It's a lion, probably the one we heard earlier this morning. You go back to those trees." We heard a lion roaring just before daylight when we were getting up.
"I'd rather stay with you."
"It wouldn't be fair to Pop," I said. "You wait back there."
"All right, but you will be careful."
"I won't take anything but a standing shot, and I won't shoot unless I'm sure of him."
"All right."
"Come on," I said to Imkola. He looked very grave and did not like it at all.
"Wapi Simba,"
I whispered. "Here," he said dismally, and pointed at the broken islands of thick, green, spiky cover. I motioned to one of the guides to go back with POM, and we watched them go back a couple of 100 yards to the edge of the forest.
"Come on,"
I said. Imkola shook his head without smiling, but followed. We went forward very slowly, looking into and trying to see through the sansevieria. We could see nothing. Then we heard the cough again, a little ahead and to the right.
"No," Imkola whispered. "Hapana, Bawana."
"Come on," I said. I pointed my forefinger into my neck and wriggled the thumb down.
"Kufa,"
I whispered, meaning that I would shoot the bastard in the neck and kill him dead. Imkola shook his head, his face dead, grave, and sweating.
"Hapana,"
he whispered. There was an anthill ahead, and we climbed the furrowed clay and from the top looked all around. We could not make out anything in the green cactus-like cover. I had believed we might see him from the anthill, and after we came down, we went on for about 200 yards into the broken cactus. Once again, we heard him cough ahead of us, and once, a little further on, we heard a growl. It was very deep and very impressive. Since the anteat, my heart had not been in it. Until that had failed, I believed I might have a close and good shot, and I knew that if I could kill one alone without Pop along, I would feel good about it for a long time. I had made up my mind absolutely not to shoot unless I knew I could kill him. I had killed three and knew what it consisted in, but I was getting more excitement from this one than the whole trip. I felt it was perfectly fair to Pop to take it on as long as I had a chance to call the shot, but what we were getting into now was bad. He kept moving away as we came on, but slowly. Evidently, he did not want to move, having fed, probably, when we had heard him roaring in the early morning, and he wanted to settle down now. Imkola hated it. How much of it was the responsibility he felt for me to Pop, and how much was his own acute feeling of misery about the dangerous game, I did not know. But he felt very miserable. Finally, he put his hand on my shoulder, put his face almost into mine, and shook his head violently three times.
Hapana, 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 buana,
he protested, sorrowed, and pled. After all, I had no business taking him where I could not call the shot, and it was a profound personal relief to turn back. All right, I said. We turned around and came back out the same way we had gone in, and then crossed the open prairie to the trees where POM was waiting.
Did you see him?
No, I told her. We heard him three or four times.
Weren't you frightened?
Peelis, I said, at the last, but I'd rather have shot him in there than any damn thing in the world.
My, I'm glad you're back, she said.
I got the dictionary out of my pocket and made a sentence in Pidgin Swahili. Like was the word I wanted.
Imkola like Simba?
Imkola could grin again now, and the smile covered the Chinese hairs at the corner of his mouth.
Hapana,
he said, and waved his hand in front of his face.
Hapana!
Hapana is a negative. Shoot a kudu, I suggested. Good, said Imkola, feelingly in Swahili.
Better, best, tandala, yes, tandala.
But we never saw a kudu bull out of that camp, and we left 2 days later to go into Babati, and then down to Kandoa, and strike across country toward Handeni and the coast. I never liked that camp, nor the guides, nor the country. It had that picked-over, shot-out feeling. We knew there were kudu there, and the Prince of Wales had killed his kudu from that camp, but there had been three other parties in that season, and the natives were hunting, supposedly defending their crops from baboons, but on meeting a native with a brass-bound musket, it seemed odd that he should follow the baboons 10 miles away from his shamba up into the kudu hills to have a shot at them, and I was all for pulling out and trying the new country toward Handeni, where none of us had ever been.
Let's go then, Pop said.
It seemed this new country was a gift. Kudu came out into the open, and you sat and waited for the more enormous ones and selected a suitable head, blasted him over. There was Sable, and we agreed that whoever killed the first kudu should move on into Sable country. I was beginning to feel awfully good, and Carl was very cheerful at the prospect of this new, miraculous country, where they were so unsophisticated that it really was a shame to topple them over. We left soon after daylight, ahead of the outfit, who were to strike camp and follow in the two lorries. We stopped in Babati at the little hotel overlooking the lake and bought some more panyan pickles and had some cold beer. Then we started south on the Cape to Cairo road, here well-graded, smooth, and carefully cut through the wooded hills overlooking the long yellow stretch of plains of the Maasai steppes, down and through farming country, where the dry-breasted old women and the shrunken-flanked, hollow-ribbed old men hoed in the cornfields, through miles of dusty miles of this, and then into a valley of sun-baked, eroded land where the soil was blowing away into clouds as you looked, into the tree-shaded, pretty, whitewashed, German model garrison town of Kandoa, Arangi. We left Imkola at the crossroads to hold up our lorries when they came, put the car into some shade, and visited the military cemetery. We intended to call on the DO, but they were at lunch, and we did not want to bother them. So, after the military cemetery, which was a pleasant, clean, well-kept place, and as good as another to be dead in, we had some beer under a tree in shade that seemed liquid cool after the white glare of a sun that you could feel the weight of on your neck and shoulders, started the car, and went out to the crossroads to pick up the lorries and head to the east into the new country.